In this episode, we speak with Dr. Sacha Hepburn, who teaches African history at Birkbeck University of London. We speak with Dr. Marie Huber, who teaches African history at the Humboldt University of Berlin. And we speak with Nicole Beardswood, who's a postdoctoral researcher in politics and international relations at the University of Pretoria. In this episode, we speak about the rise of international organizations and African states. We talk about the IMF and the World Bank and their different roles. We talk about the United Nations. And we talk about the shifting narrative of Africa within international relations broadly. So now we speak with Dr. Sacha Hepburn, who teaches African history at Birkbeck University of London.
The question really is, today, what exactly is the engagement, or what has been the engagement of all these organizations with African states and African leaders?
So the organization, sort of the UN organization I know most about is the International Labour Organization. So I'll speak about that first. So the ILO, when it was, I know most about kind of its early years and into the kind of years of decolonization. So that's what I'll focus on. As you mentioned, you know, the ILO emerges as, you know, part of the Versailles peace process. And, you know, really its key aims were, you know, it was aiming to secure social justice, prevent kind of labour unrest. And those aims were about securing a lasting peace in Europe and across the world. So, yes, it's aiming to kind of improve conditions for workers. But part of that is because there's a fear that labour unrest, you know, is a threat to peace. So there's different things going on there in terms of what it's trying to do in the interwar period. I mean, the ILO was dominated by colonial powers during the interwar period. You know, Britain and France were the most powerful members of the League of Nations, and they were the most powerful members of the ILO in terms of their kind of global political power, but also because they had the largest empires at that point. Also within the ILO, you have other colonial powers such as Belgium, Italy, and Japan. All of those member states had colonies, and all of the sort of colonial powers at the time, apart from Portugal, became permanent members of the ILO's governing body. So, you know, setting out the kind of remit and approach of the organisation. It's inherently tied up with colonialism. The United States and USSR are not initially members of the ILO. So we've got that kind of early establishment of this organisation is very much one which is tied up with colonial power dynamics. And that plays out in a number of ways in terms of the kind of allocation of resources, the type of issues that are focused on. You know, it's very much a focus of the ILO looking at industrial wage labour, and there's and that's the kind of, you know, labour which
it's fashionable.
It's fashionable and it's really key in Europe and the broader Western world. You know, the organisation pays much less attention to non-industrial labour, including agriculture, even though there are poor working conditions in those sectors across the world, including in the West. You know, they're focusing very much on industrial wage labour, in large part, as I mentioned, because of, I mean, it's easier in a sense to kind of regulate those sectors, but equally those are the sectors that tend to have more powerful unions, and I think there is a link between kind of trying to keep, you know, improve conditions in those sectors in order to minimize labor militancy. Now throughout the interwar period, the sort of labor issues in the colonial world, and that's across the entire world, they were organised by something called the Native Labour Section. Now, the Native Labour Section, from 1919 till 39 was never staffed by more than 3 people. That gives you a sense of how significant labour issues in the colonial world were to the ILO in the interwar period. Just 3 people coordinating all that work. And it is suggestive, I think, of the kind of the extent to which they were able to really kind of engage with those issues. I mean, that's not to say that there weren't a range of different conventions being passed and work being done to improve conditions for colonised workers. There were a range of different things going on, but colonised workers didn't have that same ability to kind of shape what was going on within the organisation because they didn't have that kind of direct representation. There were workers' representatives, so there are examples of trade unionists from East Africa, Indian workers' representatives, within the ILO, because it has a tripartite structure of governments, of workers' organisations, of employers' organisations. So there was representation of colonial workers, but it was an uphill battle really for them to get much of a kind of a say over what was happening. And this imbalance only starts to shift during the era of decolonisation. And during the 1960s, particularly, we have a number of newly independent African nations joining the ILO. And those nations secured sort of technical assistance from the ILO to help them with institution building, to help them to develop national development plans, to try to secure, to try to improve economic growth. And there was, support from member states, African member states, about, that type of assistance. It was gratefully received, not least because the ILO was, in theory at least, neutral within the Cold War. It tried to kind of maintain, it tried to remove itself from Cold War politics. So it was a way for African nations to kind of try and secure assistance without having to kind of turn to the Cold War powers directly. Now, my own sort of work on the ILO, I've only kind of got to this point with what I'm doing, sort of looking at this early years of decolonisation. And all I'd say is there were, clearly these improvements in the sense that African nations get their own direct representation within the ILO because they become full member states. But there were still, significant legacies of that earlier period of colonial dominance in terms of who actually is a kind of senior and junior partner within the organisation. The former colonial powers, Britain, France, but also, the United States, they remain the most sort of powerful members of the organisation. And we have, newly independent African, Asian states, Latin American states, still kind of being treated like junior partners in many ways within the organisation. And there are a number of clashes over how, over sort of labour issues and how best to approach labour issues and sort of social justice issues on the continent, and a kind of pushback often from African leaders over what the types of sort of conventions and policies that the ILO wants to pursue on the continent. And I think a feeling that the ILO is trying to pursue policies without having the necessary kind of contextual, sort of political, cultural understanding of labour conditions.
Now, the early half of the 1960s was the harbinger of new states on the African continent. It marked a turning point as all these African territories gained independence. And in 1960, 14 French-speaking states joined the United Nations. Benin, Burkina Faso, Cameroon, Central African Republic, Chad, Cote d'Ivoire, DRC, Gabon, Madagascar, Mali, Niger, Congo, Senegal, Togo. And they were welcomed on that day by the SG Dag Hammarskjöld. Many other nations would join as the decades progressed. An organization created in the wake of World War II and done to cement the New World Order by the Allied victors. African states had to navigate within these new corridors of the United Nations, their very existence on the world stage. Now, let's hear what Dag Hammarskjöld had to say when he welcomed these new states into the United Nations.
We have too much in common not to turn the simple human values, which are our common heritage, into the firm foundation on which we may unite our strength and live together in peace.
So now we speak with Dr. Nicole Beardsworth, who is a postdoctoral research fellow in politics and international relations at the University of Pretoria.
I think there was a kind of growing consensus around multilateralism. So what we saw is like the rise of organizations like the Southern African Development Community, SADC, and ECOWAS. I don't know as much about ECOWAS, but you see the kind of growth in multilateralism and a sort of growing, growing inclusion within the OAU. But of course, the OAU in the sort of late 80s and late 90s was more what everyone sort of refers to as a kind of dictator's talk shop. It did very little to encourage multi-party democracy until the early 2000s, until it was, I believe it was relaunched in 2003. And then had a much stronger agenda for promoting democratization on the African continent and promoting citizen welfare, which is ultimately the agenda of the AU now. But in terms of how the foreign policy of those countries shifted, I think it's a very interesting question because I think there was a growing caucus of African countries operating at the UN, and they were more likely to act as a bloc than they had previously when they were riven with the sort of superpower rivalries. Mm. In terms of the Olympics and other international fora, I mean, I'm really not sure. I think that's a really interesting question, and I don't think I have any good answers for it.
So now we speak with Dr. Marie Huber, who teaches African history at the Humboldt University of Berlin.
Once the day when Amadou Mbow became the Director General of UNESCO, I think marking the beginning of what is called the African Decade at UNESCO, I think that is another really interesting date to look at, because not only was it one of the first times that such an extremely high post was decorated by an African, it was characteristic for the beginning of a period of a lot of Africa-focused and even Africa-centered initiatives at the UN level and programs. And I'm not speaking here about the bigger development funding programs or bigger diplomatic things that were discussed in the UN and the UN Security Council or the World Bank Group. No, I'm discussing the beginning of projects such as the UNESCO's General History of Africa, the tailoring of literacy programs towards the needs of African states, which had an entirely different situation if it came to primary education, and even just creating literacy in a region where multilinguality was the norm and a lot of the language spoken actually didn't have a written form, but most people agreed that primary education or providing a general education to everyone is an important step towards development, or is an important step for development. So, and I think, you know, just as much as politically and economically, being seen culturally as a nation or as a continent with history, with tradition, with a cultural potential, so to speak, this is something that unraveled a bit, that unravel a bit in this African decade at UNESCO. After that, maybe decline, or it's also interesting to follow how that idea developed and how it ended up. A lot of African intellectuals came together in a spirit that I think is very important to understand, and it's important to learn to get a better sense.
That's very interesting.
Africa. A really large number of new nation states, the newly independent African nations, joins the United Nations. And they certainly manage to push a whole different agenda in the general orientation of the United Nations. So while there were existing development programs before, and while the colonial origins of the United Nations is important to have in mind, it is also important to see that then in the 60s, this changed and this took over. And so Africa became a focal point because of all those newly independent nations which joined the UN as new member states. The majority of them was African. So certainly, in a way, you could say that certainly, I always try to imagine that, you know, in the offices, also in New York or Paris, they were certainly populated with a number of Africans, which maybe they had served in different political functions before. Also before the independence, they had served in some political or other professional function. And not to say that it was that they were first-time visitors, you know, to the U.S. or to Paris or to France or whatever. But they were there in a new function they represented. So Africa, if one wants to put it that way, I can certainly say this for the UNESCO, Africa became the most important playing field for the programs of the United Nations and the United Nations specialized organizations. There was by far the largest development need. I mean, Latin America and Asia, there were massive in terms of programs, but Africa really became this, you know, I can't give you the numbers, and it would be interesting if someone would go through the pains of doing this. The sheer number of UNDP programs, for example, if I look at a country like Ethiopia, so it's really overwhelming, yeah? And just how many, another thing I found striking in the African governments I studied is just how many even most basic functions of the government and administration has been built up through UN programs. So that is something, besides the peacekeeping and besides the development efforts, I like to look at this kind of this backstory. It's not as spectacular, but if you look at the sheer number of people who served as advisors or who provided expertise, who served as consultants, who served as temporary, while they weren't working for the governments, they were kind of advising the governments, African governments, how they should build up. And this is what I call the state building process. Yeah. How can you make this a government? Well, one that also is able to actually work and interact with the existing UN system. I have so many cases where I read, well, we would like to apply for assistance, or we have this program where states can apply for assistance, but actually most of the applications we receive, they don't fulfill all the necessary formal requirements. So we will send people who help national governments to actually write better applications so they can actually draw the funds from our programs. And I think this is for me is a very fascinating aspect to look at how bureaucracy was expanded and made more internationally compatible through the works of the UN. And I think it had also quite an impact on the continent. So this is an aspect I like to bring up in regards to this question. And maybe one last thing I can say is to come back actually to the peacekeeping operations. It's interesting that through the UN, another layer of, like I said, like those Africans who were now state delegates in the offices of the UN, UNESCO, FAO, whatever headquarters, but you also have African peacekeeping soldiers now, for example. You have and they go to Korea, for example, that the social mobility and actually the physical global mobility that military could provide. And then when you serve in the military, it's always temporary. And then what happens when you come back? How do you change, you know, how does that also change societies? How does that change the national military if you come back from such a peacekeeping mission? Yeah. So this this is an interesting aspect, and you can certainly play this out for other sectors. Also, again, the cultural sector, the education sector.
Exactly. I mean, let's conclude by just discussing the legacies of all these things we've talked about on the continent. But one thing I'd like to just point out is, you know, we had, you know, in the last 30 years or so, a revitalization of regional communities. You know, you mentioned that the regions are very important. So in West Africa, we have ECOWAS, which is free movement of goods and people.
Mm-hmm.
In East Africa, we have the East African Community, which was formed in 1967 and then collapsed, revived in 1977, and then brought again in 2000. And you have countries like Burundi, Rwanda, Kenya, Tanzania. And also in South Africa, we have the SADC, South African Development Corporation. So how exactly have all these things been legacies of, you know, the United Nations intervention and also, you know, state formation and centralization and all the things you've talked about, in addition to other things you believe are legacies for the continent?
So one thing I think we should bring more attention to is these institutional legacies in terms of state administration. I can bring in the example from my research again, which is heritage making. So the fact that national heritage, the way it is inscribed legally, or it's institutionalized legally and as a branch of the state administration at a national level, that we owe that to a UNESCO effort. So, and that is a legacy of the UN. So, and that created one of the results is that national heritage was set up as a top-down process in most African states, and that nowadays, of course, in line with the changing UNESCO policies as well, which foresee or which demand a more integrated community-based approach to developing heritage sites, which broaden the categories and concepts of heritage so that you now can also inscribe cultural landscapes and not just monuments, for example. That transformed, but once again, it has to then be changed on this national level now, even if there can be a regional initiative, for example, to make something World Heritage, a national heritage site, and after that maybe UNESCO World Heritage, it has to pass these institutional structures that were created in the first place, which don't have a tradition that goes back a century or longer, but that is very recent, and that was kind of imported, so to speak, as a concept. And this is what I mean when I speak of institutional legacies, and for how many other sectors, because also on an institutional level, a sort of path dependency can be created.
Mm-hmm.
That then makes it difficult to introduce changes to, that makes it difficult, even with all the best intentions, to actually bring in a new community based or a regional approach, for example, yeah, because you have to completely change entire chains of decision making processes, for example, and that can be very difficult, especially if the government doesn't have a lot of capacities to begin with. And there simply isn't the time to build lots and lots of committees who can see how to implement institutional change. So the existing institutions, they just keep on working, sort of. We have a very strong global economic system and global economic order at the moment, but I don't see this necessarily becoming more important at the expense of the national category. I think actually still the national framework, and to have a nation state or to have political decision making and political representation at a national level is still very important, partially because of these legacies, and partially because we have the structure of the international order. We have the system, and governments keep working together on important issues within the system.
Yeah, exactly. Despite grievances here and there and conflicts here and there, they still cooperate a lot together.
Yeah, so I think the role of states is also ever more important. I also think, we have behind us now roughly 20, 30 years of structural adjustment programs in Africa, which have tried to decenter the state and the economy, and the results have not been exactly convincing, I guess. So I think we will see a renewed importance of states and of what governments can do. And hopefully more of this renewed importance will also be carried by a broader popular vote, which to make whatever changes come about more sustainable and bring more stable results.
Yeah.
Yeah. From that change. And also for that, the national level, the state administration, it's an important framework. There are good institutions that this can be built on, I think. So that